Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And happy Thursday, everyone. Welcome to the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And Jim, we begin with the good martini, and we touched on this subject to some extent earlier this month when a federal court ruled that the NSA did not have power through congressional legislation for bulk collection of our data. And you, of course, made the key point at the time that there should be a big difference between how American citizens are treated by the government and how foreign people are treated, and certainly people who are considered to be terrorist threats. Rand Paul yesterday filibustering on the Senate floor, talking about his concern about reauthorizing certain parts of the USA Patriot Act. And here's a couple of clips from what he had to say. The first one is about our Fourth Amendment rights and what exactly is our personal papers.
Your emails being stored on some server somewhere, I see no way that it could be construed that you've given up your right to privacy because someone else is holding the records for you, because that's the way in the digital age we've come to hold records.
And the other question he said is that if you want to investigate anyone, particularly an American citizen, go get a warrant. And he says the arguments used by those who think it's okay to go get that warrant after the fact don't hold water constitutionally.
People complain and they say, oh, it'd be taking too long and be inconvenient. Make it better then. Put your judges on 24 hours a day. Appoint 24 more judges and put them on call all the time, and let's do this. There's no reason why you can't have security and liberty at the same time.
It's a tough issue. You can see the arguments from both sides, certainly from a conservative perspective, but you got to salute Rand Paul for sticking up for the Fourth Amendment rights of Americans.
Oh, absolutely. And it's kind of interesting that we've seen two previous serious filibusters, old-fashioned guys standing and talking for hours and hours, one from Rand Paul a couple years ago, and then a short while later, Ted Cruz. The original one from Rand Paul was about a fairly reasonable request asking the administration to pledge that they will not use drone strikes to kill an American citizen on U.S. soil without a trial. That's a lot of qualifiers. And what's interesting is that until the filibuster, the Obama administration was, now we can't make that promise. You know, we might need to do that someday. You're out there, you know, sitting in your Starbucks. We've tried you in absentia and concluded that you're a national security threat. We got to take you out. Death from the skies. Tough luck. Here comes Skynet. And so, again, I think Rand Paul has figured out how to use the filibuster in a way that really says, hey, here's a really – it's something the government is doing that people may not all be totally aware of. And I know that there's been a considerable amount of disagreement amongst Republicans on this. I think his position that the government must not have unfettered access to all of the stuff that you send, all of your metadata, seems pretty reasonable, that you can't have that and still have the Fourth Amendment mean anything. Now, one of the ideas being tossed around is – this data gets kept by the phone companies, it gets kept by the internet companies, and that when they want that information, the government can access it after going to a warrant or going to a FISA court, or there's some sort of system that allows them to check it when they need it, but not without just willy-nilly whenever they feel like it, whenever they want. I salute Rand Paul as a guy who's got the courage of his convictions, knows exactly what he thinks. I think there's going to be a considerable debate about this in Republican circles, and I don't think everyone in the party is going to agree with Rand Paul, but I think he votes for that. He speaks for a lot of folks in representing some sense that, look, the NSA and the system of data gathering has gotten completely out of control. We can't trust the Obama administration with this, and we must be very wary about trusting any future president with this.
Jim, you brought up a very interesting point there, and that's the fact that we've now seen three real filibusters in just the past couple of years, thanks to Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. I know Republicans, and for good reason, are leery about rule changes in the Senate and so forth, whether it's judicial filibusters, regular filibusters. Wouldn't it be nice, though, if you actually had to do a real filibuster? You'd still get your cloture vote. You still need 60 votes to move the legislation. You need 41 to stop it. But you'd actually have to put some sweat equity into stopping legislation, you know, actually put an effort out there.
If you're going to filibuster, earn it, man. Go big or go home.
Anyway, on to the bad martini now, Jim, and don't look now, but we're less than 3 months away from the first Republican presidential debate for the 2016 cycle. August 6th, I believe, is the date. Fox and CNN each have pretty early debates in this cycle, and the bad part is the way that they're trying to limit the number of people on stage. We are expecting, obviously, a large number inside the Republican field. Fox and CNN have decided they don't really want everybody on stage at the same time. They're going at it in two different ways. CNN is going about it by having basically two different debates, one with the people with they consider the best shot at winning and the rest of the field getting a separate time with the panel. And then Fox has decided that they're just going to go with the top 10 in the polls. So if you're not in the top 10, you just don't get to play. So obviously you can't have 35 people up there, but for the networks to decide this early who's a legit candidate and who's not seems a little bit unfair.
This had started out as the very reasonable logistic issue of, look, we could have probably 16 or 17 Republican candidates. It's very tough to have a debate with that many people. One, like, you need a big stage. Two, they get really crammed together and there's always a chance they'll start elbowing. Three, how much time does each person get? And just kind of a sense of how much of an impression do you get to have? Do people get to interact with each other? Do they get to respond to what the other person said? Or does it just kind of turn into a mess? So you understand the networks want to put a cap on this. And they don't want everybody who just shows up and says, look, I'm a Republican presidential candidate. You got to let me in. Particularly since we kind of suspect that some of the people in this field are running for either vice president or a cabinet post or a Fox News gig after the election or a bigger book deal afterwards and speaking fees. That's cynical, but we have those suspicions for reasons. So where do you do the cutoff? And two networks have come up with two slightly different approaches, but effectively the same. Fox News says you're in the top 10. And afterwards, we'll do something with you, you know, to be determined. And CNN says, we're going to have the grown-up table and then the kids' table. The other metaphor I like to think of, Greg, is that we're going to have the NCAA tournament of the top 10. And then you remaining six or seven, you get to go to the NIT tournament. And if you win the mini debate that we hold afterwards, probably airing at 3 a.m. or something, you get to chant, we're number 11, you know. neither one of these seems particularly satisfying, since particularly as of right now, the top 10 does not include Carly Fiorina and Bobby Jindal, the only woman in the field. And two, I think, you know, a guy who, pretty successful governor, enacted a lot of conservative reforms. You know, the only Indian American in the field. Ace of Spades had a very good, you know, kind of long essay on this saying, look, this is the first debate. You can't judge it by name ID because participating in the debates is how these candidates introduce themselves to the broader general public. And I think he's got a very solid point there. So he suggested splitting the field into two, doing two debates over two nights, you know, half the field with one, half the field with other. It does seem like it's a little early to start saying to, you know, the bottom six or seven, sorry, you're not big enough to compete in this. If they really do stick with this, they have just created this enormous incentive to do national television advertising in those final weeks before the debate because you need to be in that top 10. And oh, by the way, at this point, number 10 is Rick Perry, another guy who I think, you know, is a serious contender, serious record down in Texas. Again, you're going to leave these guys off for like Donald Trump? Really? It strikes me as a flawed approach right now. And you probably would like these networks to get as many of these guys on stage as possible, even if you have to break it in or, as you know, you and I had kind of joked earlier, play-in rounds like the actual NCAA tournament.
I think that's the way to go, actually. And we should have trademarked it. We talked about it at the time because I saw that yesterday ex-Urban John came out with his own bracket, a Sweet 16, if you will, of presidential contenders on the Republican side, seeding each region 1 through 4. So even if we don't get royalties for this, Jim, we're starting a good idea here. And I don't know who gets to seed all these people, but, you know, could be the first 116 upset ever.
We're innovators, Greg. And the other thing I thought of is, that, look, since clearly there's a real problem with this, and obviously every network, we should just take one of the news networks. I mean, obviously MSNBC's ratings aren't that great, but, you know, pick one and just turn it into a GOP debate channel. Just all the time. Just this all constantly ongoing. You just tune in, see who showed up tonight and who's debating with each other. Candidates could come, candidates could go. And it just would, you know, moderators could rotate in and out and it would just constantly be going 24/7. And then no one could complain. They didn't get enough exposure. There weren't enough debates.
Jim, if Reince Priebus just heard that, I think his head exploded.
There you go.
That was the whole point of this system. But it's a good problem to have. It's a weird problem to have. You know, maybe you can put a few of them in the Democratic debate just to get some airtime, since there's going to be plenty of elbow room on that stage, it appears.
You know, do a crossover, you know, like just make it, you know, all of a sudden, like you have, you know, presuming Hillary, you know, lowers herself to participating in any of the debates, you know, the queen may not think she, you know, she needs to interact with the peons. But you get Bernie Sanders, you get Martin O'Malley, you get Jim Webb, and then throw in Mike Huckabee. Throw in Rick Santorum or Ben Carson and just watch it explode, right? Watch them just go at it. One, I think obviously all the Republicans would love that. I think the Democrats would kind of like it because everybody gives everybody a villain to run against. And, you know, it might make for really good television.
Just like interleague play. I
there you go. Exactly.
All right. We're just innovating all over the place. All right. On to the crazy martini now. And this is from the Washington Free Beacon. A Democratic congressman who still owes millions of dollars in legal bills racked up while fighting corruption allegations said on Monday that members of Congress need a raise in order to cope with the District of Columbia's cost of living. Florida Democratic Congressman Alcee Hastings said at a Monday Rules Committee hearing that members of Congress who make an average of $174,000 per year aren't being paid properly. Quote, members deserve to be paid, staff deserves to be paid, and the cost of living here is causing serious problems for people who are not wealthy to serve in this institution. And Jim, it's also weird that one of his strongest allies on this issue is Jim Moran, who we're thrilled is no longer in Congress. He represented the district in Virginia right next to Washington, D.C., a guy who got to commute from home every day. It's usually the people who have two residences that make the argument here. And it's just the people who want more money in their pocket seem to be the most excited about this.
I understand Moran had a lot of expenses for his airfare, going all the way to National Airport, getting on the plane, flying around in circles for a bit, landing, and then taking the shuttle into Washington, D.C. Hastings is a particularly vivid one, but there's been a kind of a half-formulating column in the back of my head looking at this, because the congressman make, what, $174,000 a year?
Yes.
Okay. That's like, what, 3 or 4 times the average income of an average American?
Yes, definitely.
All right. So by most standards of Americans, he's very wealthy. I think that number puts in, if not the richest 1%, then the richest 2 or 3%. So he's already got a very sweet life. Now, yes, you have to have some place to stay in Washington, D.C., and you have to have your district and your home and all that stuff. But these guys get travel expenses covered. These guys get an office stay. They get unbelievable benefits, things like that. But you look at all this, and he just kind of seems to think that for the work that he does, the 174 isn't enough, and that he really should live like a big shot. And one of the things that's been fascinating, we've seen the big scandal about Hillary and Bill and their giant speaking fees and various other questions about, you know, Chris Christie living kind of high on the hog and getting lots of stuff comped at New Jersey sporting events and you know, getting flown around in private planes. Huckabee flies on private planes a lot, built his, you know, beachfront home in the Florida coast. Everybody seems to think they're entitled to live like lifestyles of the rich and famous. And look, we're on the right. We're conservatives. We believe in the free market. If you can make a lot of money, good for, you know, honestly, good for you. Go enjoy it. But you kind of notice that we now live in the era of, in some cases, millionaire university presidents. Quite a few are in the high six figures. Heads of charities making millions of dollars or you know, I believe Jim DeMint is making $1 million a year or close to it at the Heritage Foundation. Now, we love Jim DeMint, right? But at some point, you kind of reach this point of a lot of positions that were not considered millionaire positions or high six-figure positions have become that. And they're nonprofits, and they're not meant to be heads of CEOs. And what's kind of fascinating is almost everybody in American life in the year 2015 believes that they're entitled to make the kind of money that once was a Fortune 500 CEO salary. That's kind of an unnerving turn of that. And to see Hastings expressing it so openly really makes it kind of fascinating that he will do that. And at the same time, we're allegedly in this grand populist era in which we resent rich people for having so much more money than the rest of us.
Yeah, very well said. And for those of you thinking, I've heard of Alcee Hastings. I wonder why he's in debt so much. He was a federal judge. And 2 years after Jimmy Carter appointed him to the federal bench, the FBI conducted a sting operation designed to catch Hastings soliciting bribes in exchange for reducing racketeering sentences. So your sympathy might be dwindling a little bit for his financial woes.
If there was a way to give a raise to everybody in Congress except him, I might accept that plan.
Oh, very good. All right, Jim, we'll do it again tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.